This episode of The Disciplined Investor is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will U.S. oil production exceed 13.63 million barrels per day for March 2025? The yes forecast contract recently traded at 12% and the no was at 86%. With Interactive Brokers forecast contracts, you can trade on future events like climate change and the economy, politics, and more. You can choose yes or no. And if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Explore trending data on U.S. oil production. Spot the trends and make your prediction for March 2025. Trade forecast contracts at Interactive Brokers and earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. And you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Now, forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. Interactive Brokers is a member of SIPC. Last trading day for this contract is May 29th.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
We got the art of the steal. Powell holds firm on rates and a big announcement happened. A UK deal. Was it a big deal or not? China meeting set for this weekend, and our guest today, Dan Fajella, founder of Emerge AI Research. All this and much more on episode number 920 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Hey, how are you? How about that? Someone got spooked and decided to toe the line with the markets. That's what I see, at least. And then we had the Fed. Not budging at all, not making any kind of, not blinking. Nope. Even though there is a lot of pushback from the administration. Well, a good mid-May to you, Andrew Horowitz, here to discuss all the fun things that happened this week in the markets. And it's been a real hoot, hasn't it? I mean, it's not just this week. It's the last several weeks, last several months. I mean, from there is no chance that tariffs will be lifted, changed, reduced, or eliminated on China. That was Wednesday, to Thursday's news that, well, China's tariffs may get lowered. And then we have the Fed. And what happened there? Well, that was Wednesday, right? Wednesday, we saw the Fed Chair Jerome Powell. He held a press conference following the committee's policy announcement where they didn't do anything. Did anybody really think that there was going to be any chance for a rate reduction at this point, considering all the things that we know from an economic standpoint? If we are not emotional and we're not being political, the fact is that from an economic standpoint, we still have some inflationary pressures. We've talked about that and we've really got into that on DH Unplugged, myself, John C. Dvorak, this week, which happens, by the way, on Tuesdays. You can get that over on Amazon, on Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, or YouTube. We talked about that ad nauseum. We've been talking about the Fed and how even though they're being coerced and they're being nudged and pushed and prodded, the fact is that this is no reason for them to reduce rates at this point. It doesn't seem logical at all from all the information. All right, putting aside maybe GDP, that there was some pull forward effects, but even we heard from like Navarro and some of the other people and players at the White House that they loved the GDP print, even though it was negative. So you can't have it both ways, or maybe you can right now. I don't know. It seems that maybe you can't have it both ways. You can't have no changes in tariffs to, yes, we're making changes in tariffs to, oh, they're the worst country in the world, but now they did some kind of deal where they're buying something and we love them. Right? But Jerome Powell, this press conference he had, he emphasized the need for this cautious approach due to, you know, the economic uncertainties that are out there. And he mentioned that the Federal Reserve decided, obviously, to keep rates steady because The main reason? Well, the ongoing tariff negotiations by the administration. One of the things that was really fascinating was that he used the word wait, W-A-I-T, wait, 25 times in his speech following the release. So that the release is at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 2:30, he comes out, he wants to see how markets reacted. They leave a half hour, I guess, a cooling off period, an analysis period. And then he came back and he talked about how we need to wait. In fact, in the first 6 minutes of the presentation, the phrase wait and see was used more than six times. In the first 6 minutes. So I guess Powell is kind of serious about the idea of waiting and seeing. Waiting and seeing. Waiting and seeing. Now, of course, President Trump expressed his disagreement with the decision by the Fed to maintain these interest rates. And he said he believed that it was not timely to cut interest rates. That was Powell, and Trump is disagreeing, right? Yeah, Trump called him a fool. He said it's too late. But I got to tell you something. At this point, what we have to do as smart, disciplined investors is we need to fully disregard pretty much everything like this. We need to think this is just unimportant gibberish. It's sophomoric banter that is only being used to pressure and to prod. And I think that in this environment that we have right now, right in front of us, there's something to be said about investors, you and I, with these longer-term time horizons, to pretty much just ignore some of these goings-on. Because right now, it's all about egos. It's all about, you know, who's going to win at any cost. And we, you and me, we're going to be stuck in the middle. We're going to be ping-pong balls being smashed back and forth, or pickleballs the way it is. We're going to be getting absolutely ransacked by all of this nonsense. If we're not smart, if we're not disciplined, if we don't do what we're supposed to be doing with the long term in mind. And I think that's a really important issue. Because right now what we have in our current environment is a lot of inconsequential conversations that are going on that we don't know what to believe and what not. And it doesn't really matter because the powers that be believe what they're doing for whatever reason that they have that is the right thing to do, whether it's because of egos, whether it's because of political gain, whether it's because maybe, in fact, some of it is beneficial to the economy. But when you look at some of the things, like, for example, the back and forth commentary about how much China is going to pay or not, I mean, I don't think we need to really be dealing with this. I think that we as investors stuck in the middle of all of this need to realize that we have bigger goals and ambitions. We have bigger opportunities awaiting us. We have the thought of financial stability, financial security, financial independence that we are looking for the long term. And with that in mind, a lot of times what we have to do is nothing more than sit on our hands. Now, there are some other things that we can do to enhance our investments, but just hold that thought for a second, because the last we heard about, and I want to prove this point to you, about why we don't have to react so much. Because last we heard midweek was the idea there was this UK deal done, right? There was a deal done with the US. That was the first deal. It was the best deal ever. And what was it? All told, it was really the UK pulling back some red tape on imports and buying planes from Boeing, about $10 billion of planes. But we're not clear what that means, are we? Is it going to be UK companies? Is it going to be the military? What time period? 10 years? 5 years? And how much of that is already included in to make this deal look really good? Now, meanwhile, look, $10 billion of planes from Boeing is no small number. That's pretty impressive. I think Boeing does about $400 billion or $500 billion of sales a year. So this is a reasonable number. I think that's the number for Boeing. Let's look that up real quick in the background. But the fact is that when we look at what the deal was, we really don't have the total. I don't think we have the total deal that seems to be this amazing thing. Tariffs are going to remain at 10%, by the way. Some steel tariffs, aluminum tariffs are going to be brought down. Car tariffs on exports, Land Rover, the like, which are made or basically made and exported from the UK into the US, we're going to have a lower auto. So auto seems to be the big deal. That big hot button is autos. That's going to be a big issue. But again, we're going to have a lot less tariffs there. They're going to have a lot less tariffs. That evens out the playing field of where we were before. So I think that when we look at the reality of this, is there an incremental difference? I don't think so. Actually, Boeing, I just looked it up, $70 billion last 12 months. So this is pretty good. Pretty good. Last quarter, they did $20 billion. So $10 billion is a nice number. Again, we don't know. Is that going to be over a 5-year, 10-year period? Usually these deals are over a period of time. That's how it works. So stocks moved up. Why? Because the facts don't really matter. As long as we get a victory lap that can be taken with the idea that tariffs are no longer to linger and above the now seemingly embedded and acceptable 10% rate that is going to be across the board, again, suddenly acceptable that 10% tariffs are okay. I mean, that being the case, markets will be relieved. Why? Because we're used to that. At least it's not 50% or 75%, leaving out China, of course. And it didn't hurt that with that victory lap, President Trump said, and I quote, "Americans should buy stocks now." That was Thursday. Now, we've seen this before, right? We've seen these kinds of commentary. I remember when Obama did it. It was at the bottom of the financial crisis. I remember when Trump did it about 3-4 weeks ago. This is also an administration that said the stock market doesn't really matter in what we're doing. Don't worry about that. Because, listen, the whole thing's gotten out of control. It's gotten silly. It's more than silly. It's getting to a point of being ridiculous. But that's why we, all of us, as disciplined investors, we're going to do something special. We're going to play this game quietly with a longer-term view. We're not going to be worrying about all these things. We're not going to be setting our hair on fire, running out in the street naked, you know, burning houses down, all that. No. We're going to be quiet. We're going to be relaxed. We're going to be disciplined. This is the way that we've been doing it here for our clients. We've been trading around positions in our TDI managed growth strategy, picking up positions that we like longer term, trading around them. And that's probably why I believe that this year, we're positive on the year for that portfolio as of today. Well, we've been positive, but I'm just saying, time stamping it right now. And I think closest to the highest all-time high of the year this year. And by the way, if you've been on the fence and you've been thinking about looking for an alternative strategy, let's talk. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and just say contact us and we'll talk to you through it. And especially if you're freaking out about what's going on right now, I mean, maybe a dose of reality, taking a look at what you're doing and how you've been doing it. I mean, what have you been doing? I mean, were you shaking out of positions? Did you sell? Did you buy like crazy? Just sit tight? What'd you do? Honestly, I'm in favor of any of the above as long as you're doing it with a discipline. If you decide, hey, I'm selling out of this because, I don't know, pick your reasoning, but I will get back in if this or this happens, or I'm going to buy into this dip or to this acceleration, you know, ramp. If you have a strategy or discipline or a reason and rationale, I'm all good with it. You need a plan and a destination in mind. You know, when I wrote The Disciplined Investor, the book, right? The Essential Strategies for Success, which I think maybe we'll start giving some copies away again. I have some copies here still. The idea when we wrote it was to come up with a way that anyone can understand the world of investing. And for some, I get it, it's easier than for others. And let's be honest. Let's be very honest. Not everyone has the desire or even the ability or, dare I say, the temperament to invest. People get scared, spooked. However, we all need to understand the basics. Even if that is so basic that we're just understanding that owning high-quality companies for the long haul is one of the best ways to create wealth for the future, then so be it. Same thing with income-producing instruments like bonds and stocks. That's what we're doing here each and every week, right? We're doing a little bit of learning. We're hearing from guests sometimes involved in the area of investing. And we could talk about, like we had taxes on recently, we'll have talking about AI, and we talk about, what are we talking about? We're talking about how not to invest with Barry Ritholtz coming up at the end of this month. And Tom Nelson will be talking to us, one of the asset allocators from Franklin Templeton. I mean, there's a lot of things that are going on and what we learn about each and every week on the show. Here's the deal. You have to practice. It's like anything else. If this is a piano lesson and we're sitting here once a week and you're hearing your instructor talk you through, coach you through, and provide feedback on how you're playing, but you don't practice it throughout the week or you do this every 2 weeks, you're not going to get any better at it. You need to practice this all the time. You need to do it even though you may not love and those tennis lessons when you were a kid or those violin lessons. This is something that you know. You know this. Practice makes perfect, maybe. Practice gives you the ability to recreate the same thing over and over again. And the more you do it, the more it becomes a natural process. The more it becomes a natural process, the more ability you have to understand what you're doing and then make adjustments on the fly. Perfect. And give yourself the opportunity to get to where you want to go. And when it comes to this discussion in particular, which is the financial environment and investments, there is no one that I'm aware of unless, look, you have a rich uncle. Maybe his name is Sam, and you're thinking you're going to get Social Security for the rest of your life. Why don't you do yourself a favor? Go over to the Social Security Administration, punch in your numbers, and see actually how much you're going to get for the rest of your life, even inflated by moderate inflationary numbers, the COLA, cost of living adjustment numbers, on an annual basis. See how much that's going to pay you. I dare say you'd be pretty surprised that you probably have to augment and enhance your Social Security with something else. If you're not saving now, when? If you're not planning now, what's your excuse? We need to look at stocks as a great place to invest in. It doesn't have to be U.S.-based. It doesn't have to be the names that you're thinking about, the Googles, the Amazons, the Facebooks, the Metas. Those don't have to be the names in your portfolio. As a matter of fact, this year in particular, the best names are not those names. They're pretty bad. Yes, they've been great for the last few years. But when it comes to the diversification, asset allocation, that flower guard we talk about, that mean variance optimized portfolio that we put together for our global allocation clients, or you know the trading portfolios that we have. I mean, the fact is there's a method to the madness. There's a process that you want to stick to. And those are the things that you need to learn on a regular basis. And it's understanding how to choose those stocks. How do you do it? Well, you look for names that have certain criteria. Now, yours may be different than mine. I'm looking for names when it comes to stock picking that have earnings momentum, earnings that are not only consistent, that are growing. I want to see ROE, return on equity, above certain levels. I want to see trading volume increasing over time. I want to see management that has the ability to provide benefit. I want to see, for example, revenues growing. And the list goes on. But these things are the key to having a business that is successful. Now, you want to pick a business that's fallen off a cliff, that maybe is bankrupt, that could come back and bounce back? Not my game. I am really not interested in those names. I don't want to find those ones that may come back or could fail. I want to know the ones that have a proven track record that I can bank on. That's how I do it. You may be just looking at technicals. I like technicals. I mean, you know that. We talked about charting, if not once, we've talked about 1,000 times. Charting is a great way to understand the current trend and where things are. You have to decide what, if any, one or combination of many tools that you will use but you need to do it. You need to do it. These are the conversations we have in the beginning of every single year. Me pushing you into making some education decisions and doing what you can to learn more. Here we are again, almost mid-year. And with all the things we had, what a great training ground. With all the volatility for you to be putting all this into practice right now. And I hope, I'd love to hear from you too. Send me a note of how you're doing this year. How the training has helped. Because I know a lot of you already sent me notes, and I want to thank you for those because it's great to hear the feedback. Great. So with that, this segment we're going to put to a rest. I want you to go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out all the things that are available over there for you. There's, of course, this podcast, DH Unplugged podcast, and you'll understand more about what we do for our clients as well. Now, let's spend a minute talking about interactive brokers because, you know, if you want to navigate political uncertainty, disciplined investors, well, you don't need to panic. You know why? Because you prepare. At Interactive Brokers, you can help protect your portfolio and hedge market risks with bonds, precious metals, even foreign exchange, all from one powerful platform. With advanced tools, global access, and low costs, IBKR helps you manage volatility and stay ahead, even in uncertain times like this. The best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. To learn more, visit IBKR.com/navigate. And our guest today is Dan Fajella. He's the founder and head research of research at Emerge Artificial Intelligence Research, and he's an internationally recognized speaker on the use cases and ROI, return on investment, of artificial intelligence in business. And since 2015, he's been focused on direct market research interviews with Fortune 500 AI leaders, AI unicorn startup founders, and leading academics. Now, Dan, the last time we talked was August 2024, not too long ago, but a lifetime when it comes to technology, right?
Oh, man. Yeah. In artificial intelligence, that's practically a decade. So lots of things moving quickly here.
Yeah. It's like dog years. It's like AI years, right? So I have a lot of questions on this. I mean, obviously, the investment implications for everything we talk about, right? Every aspect and area of this. I was listening to a variety of people talking about how one hand, 20% of the people think that AI is going to, I guess, kill off the human race. And there's other people that, you know, talk about the race to this is going to be at this period of time. Some people say it's going to be that period. But let's talk about AI use cases, strategy. Your thoughts on how you see AI transforming business, I would say decision-making, and then we could talk about businesses also over the next decade, which is a long period of time. But let's kind of start with that.
Yeah, I mean, well, look, I guess I'll give you big picture and you can tell me where you want to drill down. So in just the last 2 years, the accessibility of AI has really improved kind of leaps and bounds. So for a long, long time, every AI company, AI startup would say, yeah, you know, you don't need to be a data scientist to use our solution in drug development or banking or retail or whatever. Like, you can just kind of plug this in. But it really didn't work like that. It was very white glove, hands-on, deep integrations with specific niche data sets, lots of experimentation, lots of basically R&D flavored efforts, which are very different than IT flavored efforts, which are very kind of direct and simple compared to what it looks like to adopt AI. So it was kind of reserved for companies that are bigger, that have data science staff. With sort of the conversational interfaces we have now, the ability for these large language models to do things like search or summarization or querying an FAQ for simpler answers or whatever the case may be, there's a slew of applications that have become more accessible. That said, while within the larger enterprise, we see two groups that are actively leveraging this new kind of Gen AI LLM sort of wave. So that would be sort of the engineering side of the house. So people that are writing code sometimes are tinkering, experimenting. And then people on the creative side of the house. So writing email subject lines, designing graphics for, you know, a million banner ads they have to split test across the next, you know, 6 months, whatever the case may be. Those kind of clusters, the creative cluster and the coding cluster, seem to be doing the most in-house experimentation. Still, we're not seeing radical transformation within big enterprise. We're seeing tinkering. And we're seeing more things that were a pilot project about 3 years ago, 2 years ago, are now potentially in deployment. Maybe we're using AI to predict inventory. We're using AI to detect fraud. We've got some applications that are actually up to speed and making us some dollars. But very rarely within legacy enterprise are we doing anything that's genuinely transformative yet. I think that may change, but that's still the state of affairs. So we're more accessible, but enterprise is slow, and there's a million reasons for that.
So are you saying we're just starting at the tip of this? Because, I mean, adoption ratio of some of the things you talked about, like, for example, summarization and help and tinkering and all that, it seems very at the infancy, at the beginning stages of this.
Yeah, I mean, I would say artificial intelligence, you know, machine learning, deep learning writ large, as a science, we're way past infancy. And in terms of business applications that are viable, that could work, we are past our infancy. But enterprises are still in their infancy in adopting and embracing the tech. But yes, overall, I mean, if we go forward X number of years, the amount of progress we'll see in terms of what large language models are capable of will be absolutely unbelievable to many people. But those waves, my prediction is that we will see unbearably capable AI systems that will be strong enough almost into themselves to like completely replace departments and like do all kinds of wacky, wild, really intense stuff within the next 2 to 3 years. I think we'll see that before we see a company like Aflac genuinely overhaul the way they do CX, or genuinely overhaul the way that they do underwriting, or genuinely overhaul the way they do much of anything. There's reasons enterprises kind of stay stagnant. And I think it will only be when their lunch is being eaten, either by startups or by faster moving competitors, that they will begin doing what we could call kind of transformative AI use cases, and not the incremental kind of tiddlywinks that they've been doing for the last decade.
So is a lot of what's happening right now, the way I see this, and maybe this is really dumb, but I see it as right now it's like a giant regurgitation machine, right? It's all this information in the LLMs, and I'm just getting out like components that are pieced together from all these different places rather than actual someone coming up with something brand new. How much of the what we're seeing today, maybe from the uses that we're utilizing from the ChatGPTs, Copilots, Geminis, even some of the other ones that you look at Perplexity, et cetera. How much of what I'm getting, the output, is regurgitation cobbled together versus real thought?
Well, I mean, you know, it's tough to say what's real thought. I mean, the only honest answer to like, are these things thinking? I mean, it's like we have very rough proxies for what thinking looks like in neuroscience, never mind what it looks like in computer science. People say, well, then that just means you're a stochastic parrot. There's a lot of like world-movingly powerful AI leaders who are of the belief that, well, like, yeah, humans are mostly doing the same thing. Like we're mostly kind of completing the last word in our own lives. Now, I'm not necessarily equating ML systems to the human mind in any way. All I'm saying is, we have disgustingly low levels of granularity on what is actually happening in the brain or in the brains of these systems. The founders of these systems, I mean, the CEO of Anthropic, Sam Altman, they've all been very clear. Like, we're kind of conjuring a species here. We're not, yes, like, you know, hard coding something. We have no clue what's going on. So here's what I will tell you. Yes, is it easier for a large language model to tell me, how does the work of Lao Tzu connect the work of Ralph Waldo Emerson? Because it's already sucked up all of Lao Tzu and Ralph Waldo Emerson. Yes, it can do that easier than it can wield up an entirely new philosophical body of work of some, you know, I give it a couple of prompts of like, paint me a whole philosophy of this. You know, it'll do better at connecting the dots of what already exists. However, these systems very much can expand into areas we haven't been. They just don't have as much confidence. And that's kind of like humans too, to be honest. You know, if I got a sales team and they've been selling product A for 3 years and I introduced product B, my humans are not going to do as well with product B for 6 months, right? So, you know, on some level, are they just regurgitating? I guess, you know, but there are, you know, you listen to Ilya Sutskever, or you listen to Jeff Hinton. There's some of these folks that think they've constructed a more robust and thorough kind of world model that undergirds that, that really is the anchored basis of understanding. So some people will say, yeah, it's the Chinese room, it's just passing a bunch of stupid symbols. And others will say, no, real understanding is happening. The only consensus is there's no consensus. And these systems are better at stuff that has already been done or connecting the dots between stuff that's already been done. But they are very much able to begin to help a developer code something that's never been coded. They can definitely still help jumpstart a lot of that and help a lot of that. They can help a philosopher write about things that have never been philosophized on. They can still help with a lot of that.
Yeah, so I agree. I
mean, regurgitation, sure.
Yep.
Can they help extend into the future? Sure. And now they are increasingly being part of the next wave of data they're being trained on. So the AI systems that help an engineer build a way more complex, you know, set of dashboards or set of web features or set of whatever, now all those new features are getting sucked up by LLMs, and now LLMs are getting trained on that. And so increasingly the flywheel is spinning, the net amount of power in all directions is increasing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you hear about the idea that, well, you know, are they thinking, and they have these hallucinations, anybody's got all upset about, but truth be told, human beings and many of the great thinkers were on hallucinogenics when they came up with some of their best ideas, right?
Sure. Yes. But hallucinations are also a little bit of a strange term. I mean, it's like, okay, think about it this way. It's like, if you tell me to read, one book, never mind tell me to read millions and millions and millions of books, and then start asking me questions and see if I quote unquote hallucinate. Right. Just see if I do. Try. Right.
Yeah. I got
you. So you can do this with your own fucking memories.
Yeah.
Write down everything that happened on your seventh birthday and talk to your mom about it and figure out how much goddamn hallucinating you do.
Yeah.
And
I agree.
Do they do this thing? Sure. And we are labeling it something different than what happens in our brain. Probably because in part there is some difference between what happens in our brain. But to be frank, if I train an employee, if I have an employee read 6 different books around customer success and then go apply those principles in a set of templates, they're going to misappropriate some principle and tenet that was supposed to be applied this way, this other way, right? That's going to happen. They're dealing with complex, wacky, wild concepts. There's going to be some weird crossover where they might get something wrong. The systems are kind of doing the same thing. And then they're certainly much, much better in doing much, much less of that than they were just 6 months ago or 2 years ago. So hallucinations happen. I guess we sometimes forget, like, God, humans do a lot of the same thing.
Right. No. Misunderstanding. Let's call it not hallucinations, but let's call it, making things up. You know, I would say that the University of MSU makes shit up. But the idea of where we are right now, I want to tell you a couple of things that are going on. So I've been using a variety of different AI for testing, for playing, for checking, for, you know, thinking. And one of the things I did recently was two different calculation-based prompts, if you will, of talking about, okay, let's do an analysis of what the projected Social Security income will be for someone considering this, and then I want to do a comparison of if they wait till this year, and then what will be the differential crossover year? I gave all these prompts, right? Something that we'd have to do a whole spreadsheet on. Now, you can create a spreadsheet that's a template to do this. But then you have to do a lot of different possible alternatives. Okay, same kind of concept, but I'll tell you something. The ability to utilize that and then talk through it inside of a chat-based service is pretty cool. Plus giving me output that was easily absorbed so I could send it, let's say, out to somebody was wonderful versus starting from scratch and here's a spreadsheet, Mr. Client. Here's all your numbers and this is what it's going to be. And they're like looking at it going, huh, what's that? Right. What does that all mean versus this? The other one was, I want to do a simple estate planning calculation, utilizing a bunch of years and time and assumptions and all this. And we came up with numbers. I'll tell you what happened in my office. We did a check on it and the numbers came up different. And I'm like, why is that? So I said to the chatbot, I said, why are my numbers different? That's what I said. Why are my numbers different? Well, here are the possibilities. And it turned out, I'll tell you what it turned out to be, which I thought it was going to be. It turned out to be a rounding error differential between what the chatbot was using. In this case, it was Copilot, still a Microsoft product, by the way, and Excel. Excel uses a particular rounding. If you don't tell it to round, it uses a special rounding methodology. So you start using large numbers over periods of time with compounding. Those little bitty rounding numbers change things. So it was like, it could change a lot. You went from X million to X million plus 200, let's say. So why is there a $200,000 differential? Because you calculate something at the beginning of a period, end of period, or use rounding differentials. It's a big difference. So anyway, cool stuff you could do. Now, what are some of the biggest, I want to get into this. You talk about the AI adoption with business. What are their biggest misconceptions? What are they concerned that they are going to cannibalize themselves? Are they concerned that what's going on?
I'll give you an idea. I mean, look, it's really unfortunately a lot of the same hoopla from like 8 years ago. The short story is this: the motives to innovate within enterprise are just really shockingly bad. So if you can kind of just get your salary and do things that aren't going to rock the boat and kind of move along, like that's really the way to play the game. We'll find that, someone who leaves Wells Fargo to start some consulting company, well, now they want to sell into Wells Fargo now that they're an AI consulting company, because now if they sold and built out this project over 2 years, they'd be getting paid for those whole 2 years. But when they're working in Wells Fargo, same exact problem, okay? Same exact problem. When they're working in Wells Fargo, it's like, well, do I think I can push past all the red tape? Do I think I can push past the cultural issues are really challenging? So AI often is going to involve a lot of iteration. It's going to involve breaking up big data silos that exist in enterprises and kind of harmonizing that data and making sense of that data and being able to govern that data. We're going to have all kinds of regulatory questions if it's healthcare or retail or whatever. There's a lot of regulated stuff. People are always afraid of stepping on eggshells there. The red tape internally, the culture pressure internally, and the fact that if it goes wrong, like it might be a really tough time for me. And if it goes right, like it's not exactly a windfall for me. All of those things make it so that like actually adopting this stuff is just not really something people want to take the mantle on. Half a decade ago, a lot of them just didn't know the difference between AI and IT. Now, within the bigger enterprises, the more mature ones, many of them really robustly have an understanding of what makes AI projects different than IT. They know they're going to have to clean their data. They know they're going to have to get data scientists and subject matter experts and business leaders on the same page and flesh out a project. And they kind of have an idea of what projects might be successful or not be successful. But even with what I call executive AI fluency. We have an article on emerge.com.
Executive AI fluency.
Yeah, it's worth a Google. It's a kind of a simple framework for like, what are the kinds of leaders that can meaningfully pick out and actually deliver success on AI projects? It's like three criteria. So there's much more executive AI fluency in the enterprise now. However, the incentives are still really poorly structured for anybody to actually be willing to make change. And so we see small incremental changes. We see a lot of pushback against anything more significant. Even smaller stuff just kind of doesn't push through because it just the win is not meaningful enough. The boulders you have to move to get it started are too freaking heavy if you can just get a goddamn salary. Mm-hmm. And the downside of it flopping, could mean you don't get that nice salary. And so the consultants are incentivized to talk about innovation and to go bold and to go creative and to go over the moon because they're getting paid the whole time, even before there's an ROI. And I'm not saying consultants are wrong, by the way.
I'm not saying
they're wrong. In fact, in my opinion, if it weren't for, and this is going to sound crazy, if it weren't for the big consulting companies, people think like a Capgemini and a Cognizant and all those other guys. If it weren't for them, like a lot of the AI fluency wouldn't even exist in the higher echelons of the enterprise because they've been kind of in there trying to teach and trying to move. And some of them have great ideas within these industries, but it just takes so much legwork to make a real AI project come to life. The incentives simply haven't permitted for
Plus,
it.
Plus, so you have another back end problem, Dan. There is the potential, I think, for some people that are, even if you're working in AI, you have a self-protection mode that is this AI, even though I finish this, eventually going to put me out of work.
Oh, there's that too. This is a brilliant point. I'm really glad you brought that up, actually. There's a huge point there. There's a bunch of nuance I'd love to unpack on what you just said. So on the one side, if I am like a manager or a boots on the ground employee, yeah, maybe I do want to find ways to kind of not get on board or come up with reasons I don't like it or try to not participate or try to tell other people, don't use it. Hey, they're going to try to roll this thing out of the call center. Don't use it. Or like, hey, let's really push back against this, you know, and they might even come up with reasons. They might even not even tell themselves, hey guys, let's push back as if we're going to lose our job. They might instead push back on like, no, this is something you need a human. We want to treat customers right. But ultimately their motives are self-interested, right? It's kind of like when people tell you I did have kids or I didn't have kids because I want to help the world. It's like, no, man, you just decided if you want to have kids or not. And then you told everybody it was from benevolent means, right? It's sort of like, oh yeah, we pushed back against the technology for some good reason. Nah, man, it's just like your salary and you being able to go home at 5 o'clock and like have all your bills paid and whatnot. Like that's kind of ultimately what your motive was. So, you know, the self-interested sort of undergirded stuff, it rules the world. It rules the behaviors of
self-preservation.
It is what it is. It is. I don't morally judge it. Some people call it immoral. I call it amoral. It is not a moral thing. It is literally what organisms and organizations do. It is not moral. So, but people will justify however they want. But yes, that's part of it. Another part of it is if I'm a VP of customer success or customer experience, I may feel like my relevance is shrunken if my fiefdom is 50 people instead of 500. Right.
Yeah.
Maybe I myself and maybe my whole department because it's an afterthought because now it's just fucking software. Yeah. You know, it's not my genius in orchestrating all these people. And if honestly buffering my department out of existence is kind of what I feel like could happen, maybe I don't want that. So bottoms up, there's resistance. That middle band, there's resistance. That's definitely part of it. And so, look, I've LinkedIn posted this a billion times. I mean, I'll probably say it another billion times. It's insane how little has changed in the last 8 years in terms of adoption. Look, we got more executive fluency. We got more stuff in production. We do have some value being generated. There are some companies experimenting with LLMs, but it is still abysmally slow. The end of the day, actual real adoption, changing how CX works, changing how underwriting works, changing how inventory prediction works, changing any business function, it's only going to happen when their lunch is being eaten. And it is an existential threat from either a startup that's just dominating their industry with raw tech and way more efficiency, or B, a more nimble competitor that's eating their lunch by being more nimble and more efficient. Unless one of those two things happen, legacy industries like insurance, like pharma, like whatever, they're just going to keep operating in this humdrum world. And this is why I very much expect we're going to have levels of AI breakthroughs where these things become so unbearably capable of writing code and handling CX stuff and building infrastructure and whatever, where like a handful of people can just spin up these monsters. We're going to have systems like that that come in and just start wiping out departments of enterprises and start really remolding the economy while these dinosaurs mostly are not going to adapt. This is my current supposition. I wish in the last 3 to 4 years I could say something other than that. But nah, it's still really abysmal in terms of adoption. They're not going to do it until literally. So like the Greeks didn't unite until like the Persian boots were on their sand, right? And sometimes that's too goddamn late.
Yeah.
You feel me?
Yeah,
it's too goddamn.
Yeah.
Sometimes your buildings are on fire and your women are being taken away in boats and it's too goddamn late.
Yeah, there's an image I have of a small army on top of a mountain and a huge army is making their way up. And there's a salesman talking to the guy at the top of the army who only has bows and arrows, by the way, trying to sell him a cannon. And the guy at the top, with all these other millions of armies approaching, says, I don't have time right now to deal with this.
I love it. Oh, this is perfect.
I don't have time to deal with this. Come back in a week.
You know? This is amazing. No, you nailed it. You absolutely nailed it.
So what's do you have a compelling example of, let's say, a company that has successfully integrated AI into its operations?
You know, there's a smattering. I mean, Emerge.com is always covering use cases across different industries. And there are, you know, interesting examples in different. Normally, so here's the way to think about it. Enterprise AI is less about like, oh, Dan, tell me how Geico totally automated and overhauled X. No. Well, how it works in enterprises like this. Hey, Dan, tell me the juncture of the customer experience workflow that AI has been implemented at this company. So, you know, it's a juncture in a workflow. That's where AI is making its way in. AI is generally not overhauling anything. So at least not in legacy.
So it's it's automation intelligence, not artificial intelligence.
Kind of. There's certainly AI being used, but it's being used at a specific juncture in a workflow. So maybe, okay, let me just give you an example. There's a bank where, okay, back in the day, they used to have to schlep all this, you know, PDFs over to Pune in India and have people check and make sure all of the signatures and all the dollar values across this big fat mortgage agreement are the same goddamn number. Mm-hmm. So we're not committing to six numbers at once, okay? Right. We used to have some guy in India do all that. Now they can have AI do a good deal of that, and they can hand the weird edge cases or the unusual paperwork to humans, and now we might need less humans. That's an example of some place where enterprise is already doing this stuff. Here's another example. Do I have a bank for you that's totally gotten rid of 5,000 Philippine call center people? Not that I'm aware of, but what I can tell you is there are organizations in retail and financial services who have been able to take certain kinds of low-hanging fruit questions around password resets and refunds and other things like that, and do a little bit of a scoop off the bottom of those simple answers, and then also do another scoop off the bottom of routing. So routing means if the machine can't answer this, put it in front of a human who can. Don't put it in front of a general human. Hello, this is Stephanie. How can I help you? Where can I send you? Right? No. Put it directly to Jacob, who can handle a refund. Put it directly to, Yolanda, who can, handle your packaging concern, right? Whatever the case may be. So handling low-hanging fruit questions and then doing routing, this is stuff where AI is fitting in.
And we see that a lot. That's your traditional chatbot, right? That's, the first thing you'll see, how can I help you? At Bank of America Online, you look at the little pop-up box. First thing is you get it's like a phone tree that will actually work, but also be able to help you.
Totally.
Amazon's a great use, great case for Amazon. Do a refund can be totally automated. Or if it doesn't work out, you can click the button and you talk to the person.
This is the kind of deal. And many companies are sort of doing that kind of stuff. And here's a good golden rule. And nobody was paying attention to this 5-6 years ago in the chatbot craze. All the banks had a chatbot overnight. It was all a silly game here. Here's the deal. If, Apple, Google, Amazon, if they're not using it for this use case, in other words, if Amazon has not been able to completely get rid of humans and CS, then as a bank, you shouldn't even be thinking about it because clearly the tech is just not there. Usually we're talking about junctures of workflow. So what I said about mortgage, there's a use case for you. What I said about routing and then handling low-hanging fruit, there's a use case for you. Some of that is, there's other stuff with Gen AI where, some approvals process, right? Some approval mm-hmm. or some fraud mm-hmm. screening process, okay? Some fraud screening process used to involve all this research about the transaction and the person and the this and the that. And now we can have Gen AI stream up all the relevant info and then pre-order it in the order that it might be relevant for with regards to this particular fraud case. And then yes, maybe a human is still needed some of the time. Some of the fraud just gets screened automatically by AI. But others is put in front of a human, but because the system could kind of read and connect dots, it's able to sort things automatically, say, hey, human, here's the 5 bullet points. If you want the 5 resources that support those bullet points, here they are. You can make a human judgment. And then we can see, are those fraud decisions being made better or worse by zooming forward 12 months, 18 months and figuring out, okay, was this actually fraud when it comes down to it or was it not? Mm-hmm. So sometimes there's a lag feedback loop, sometimes there's immediate feedback loop, but these are all places where cool. Modern Gen AI stuff in some cases is finding a fit. More old school AI is in some cases finding a fit. All of these kinds of junctures of workflows, there are innumerable applications of, and there are many, many more than there were 5 years ago when it was really just proof of concept. Nobody was really deploying this stuff, not as much 5 years ago. Now there's much more of it, but it is in these junctures I articulate for you. It's much less excitement than many people would hope.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about, I have so many questions here. Let's talk about, I want to talk about your podcast because we can wrap some things in there. You're the host of the AI and Business podcast, right? It's according to your summary. It's designed for non-technical business leaders looking to leverage AI for strategic advantage. And each week you interview all sorts of AI executives from Fortune 500 firms, startups, uncovering all sorts of trends and use cases. Who's one of your more memorable guests?
Yeah, some really good ones. I mean, well, yeah, AI in business for folks who sort of really the way we think about it, Andrew, is like if you're interested in how to write code, we're just totally the wrong show for you. But if you're interested in the P&L impact of AI in specific industries and specific Fortune 500 companies or the workflow impact. So what did the work used to look like? What's it look like now? Workflow and P&L impact, that's where we focus. Some really good episodes. We had Kimberly Powell from NVIDIA on recently to talk about kind of the future of computing, which was good. Some great finance episodes. If people go to podcast.emerj.com, so just Emerge, or you just go to emerge.com, emerj.com. And then in the search bar, people can type in CIO Goldman Sachs. So we had Marco Argenti, who's the CIO at Goldman, who came on and kind of gave us some of where he sees kind of the future of more Gen AI and LLMs within the banking space. Those are certainly some fun ones.
So you had one recently, AI in healthcare, right? And you explored how AI agents are transforming workflows and automation in healthcare systems. I'm assuming the hospitals are a big tester user of these kinds of things because the amount of insurance claim work, the amount of people coming and going, the HR, there's got to be a huge use case for this in that area.
It's vastly less than you'd think. So
that's shameful.
This is really, yes. So this is really useful for the listeners to understand. So life sciences is way, way farther ahead in terms of raw spend on AI than healthcare, and probably in terms of real boots on the ground implementation of AI than healthcare. Let me count the ways for you. Let me just start counting the ways, okay? So way number one, the R&D budget of Sanofi is just bigger than Mayo Clinic. I'm sorry, okay? I'm sorry. I'm gonna apologize to you. Oh, there you are. Okay. There's the apology.
All right.
Okay? So we just don't have R&D budget. Period. Mm. Okay? I'm just telling you, we don't have it. I'm letting you know we don't have it in healthcare. Here's another thing for you. Who benefits? If I'm running Pfizer C-suite and I say, damn, if we could get any tiny edge to streamline this damn clinical trials process, which is costing us billions and billions and billions and billions every year, if we can take these three processes and just make them a little bit more efficient, that's going to smack the bottom line. Mm-hmm. Let's figure out who's running those departments. Let's have conversations. Let's push this tech into the system. Let's try to test it. Is it easy? No, it's not easy in any legacy enterprise. Get used to it. However, it is possible. It is possible for the people running the business with the people that are closer to the problem to come together, to find places where we can make an impact and push it down and at least try to get a POC rolling, at least try to get some results. Now let's go to the hospital. Who is the benefactor and the payer and the whatever for AI in the hospital? So let me give you an idea. The C-level guy wants to buy it because it's going to help the P&L. The doctor doesn't want to use it because it's going to take him an extra two steps. And he's going to tell the nurses not to use it because he doesn't want to be bothered. He thinks he's already as busy as he can be. He's a doctor. He's important. You know, he got a fancy degree, Andrew. You can't disrespect. Guy, okay? Yep. You can't disrespect this guy. There's no technology that's better than this guy. You know how much he paid for that degree, Andrew?
Mm-hmm.
He's never going to use your technology. And then it might be the guy running the hospital wants to buy it to get better patient outcomes, because better patient outcomes in some cases can loop back into kind of financial ROI based on like patient results. But again, it's like the things that the doctor likes might not be the things that the C-level leadership likes, might not be the things that the patient likes. So you add that one more variable of having, so, you know,
might I say that nobody likes anything about the current system?
Oh, no, totally not. I mean, but again, nobody knows how to fix
it. But at least we know the devil, right?
Yes. It is absolutely the devil we know. So you look in life sci, C-suite can go talk to the people that are kind of doing the stuff and we get to enough of an agreement, we're kind of kosher. But you get that third party of kind of patient, sort of doctor, sort of business leadership within healthcare. Combine that with the fact that it's wildly regulated, okay? Yes, is pharma data regulated? Sure it is. But you know what? Some some fucking chemical compound that might eventually bind with some other protein that might help with some symptom for some kind of a cancer treatment or whatever, that is less regulated than Susan McGillicuddy's diabetes stuff, Susan McGillicuddy's AIDS treatment, Susan McGillicuddy's, right? That's personal data, all right? So the level of spookiness in terms of regulatory-ness around the data is way higher in healthcare largely. Combine that with them also having less R&D budget. It is a woefully scary place to try to drive AI adoption. Hmm. Now, is it happening? Yes. Okay. I'm not telling you it's not happening. I'm just saying I'm going to tell you what the real world is like. The real world is like this. You show me 10 companies that have raised under 50 mil and they're telling you they're going to apply AI in healthcare. I'm going to look at my watch for 3 years. I'm just going to stare at my wrist for three straight years. And let me tell you what's going to happen. Three of them are going to still be on their legs. Some of them may be healthy, some of them not healthy. And they're going to be selling to pharma. Pharma is going to actually be the customer, not healthcare. Okay. Mm-hmm. The other seven are going to be dead. Mm. So that's how that works. You show me, you know, you show me some young optimists thinking they're going to go actually make money in healthcare. They all find a way to, well, you know, like, Andrew, let me tell you the most boring business model in the world. Let me just tell you. The most boring business model in the world is, oh, we could vacuum up a bunch of specific healthcare data and then sell it to people that make drugs, yeah, right? It's like everybody comes up with the same business model.
Yeah.
If I had $20 for every time I've seen that business model emerge from scratch, I wouldn't be on the phone with you because I'd be on a yacht.
Let's take this and shift gears for a second here. I want to just finish up with AI for the individual, right? A lot of our listeners are not in the corporate environment per se that are making decisions on something, but yet using and desirous of using AI for their personal means, right? And a lot of them have toyed around with, started, they looked at, they heard about, you know, and they hear this LLM and all that. Basically, that's a large language model. And basically what that is just a push in of data into something that will allow these computers to output something to you. I'm just going to make it very easy. But what advice would you give to, let's start with individual entrepreneurs looking to leverage AI in their startups?
Is kind of the idea, hey, Dan, what would you recommend they do or what would you implore them to try?
Yeah, I think it would be like, where should they start if they're just like frozen? Like, what should they be looking at? I mean, is it as simple as saying, oh, just start playing with ChatGPT and asking questions? Or is there, for example, use Salesforce and integrate their Einstein and their AI? Or would it be something even more like, you know, there are special products for different, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Sure. I'll give you an idea. The place to start ideation here, you know, it depends on the size of the business and whatnot. But you know, nowadays, even really small businesses can do the kind of adopt LLMs in a simple way. If we had this conversation 4 or 5 years ago, where should small businesses or immediate startups use AI? If they don't have a bunch of venture money, I'd probably say don't bother too much right now. But like, but that's definitely changed. So what I would say is, you know, get your team leaders to have some functional grasp of like the basics of what LLMs can do. So have them kind of jump into a Google fest of sort of where large language models and kind of agentic little workflows can kind of help out with customer success, with sales enablement, with marketing copy, with whatever their department is. Find reputable sources. Don't find a guy named, you know, Billy who's in his mom's basement playing Nintendo 64 who decided to write a blog post or create a YouTube video. Find people who seem to be reputable, seem to be applying this stuff in the real world. And then so screen for relevance to your job, screen for reputability for source, and then find a panoply of where the realistic use cases are being done there, and then be willing to have some kind of huddle with the team. You know, maybe it's a half day thing, a 2.5 hour thing, where people bring to the table, hey, here's what I think we could do to try this out. I think we could use LLMs with this specific prompt structure that we can experiment with in order to do all this, the pre-sales call research. And then we can use this other prompt structure to actually build out the customized sales deck before each call. Maybe we could try that. And then here's my other ideas. And then you can kind of rank them based on number one, how much effort would they require? And number two, what would be their financial impact? And it's almost certain that in most smaller businesses, you probably will have a few items on the table from a session like that would literally save you like 1.5 salaries even as a small company, because like, what if we didn't need people to do this manual process on LinkedIn? What if that research was doable to these other sources and these designated prompts that we could do just once every Friday? We wouldn't need these three other people doing XYZ QRS. Or it may not just be about efficiencies. It may be about improving results. Hey, what if our marketing results, like what if we got twice the response? Because if we could have our subject lines in the first paragraphs of all these marketing emails really be tailored to the specific issues that this specific company we're messaging has related to procurement, maybe that would increase our response rate. So have everybody screen for relevance, screen for credibility, and then become familiar with the panoply, and then have some suggestions. Have half a dozen suggestions of where you could put them and plot them out. Plot them out in terms of money and time they would take and in terms of impact they might have, and be willing to, quarter over quarter, do light incremental experimentation. Maybe each departmental leader per quarter picks one of these experiments to run that they think is highest impact relative to the amount of effort that it's going to require, and they give it a shot. And before the next quarterly meeting, you get together, you say, how was our tech experiments? Were we able to drive efficiencies, drive more results with what we thought? And if you do even two loops of that, you'll be way farther ahead in terms of small biz or startup AI adoption than the vast majority of companies are now. So in terms of a place to start, pull in more brains than yourself as the CEO for sure, if you have more brains than you. But if it is just you, you can do the same thing I just said. But that would be sort of an educated way to move forward. And there's hardly any company that can't squeak out some serious ROI if they can be nimble.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Dan Figella, always fascinating. Really, seriously, I'm not kidding about this. I don't tell everybody that. Some people are boring. You are fascinating, my friend. When you're down in Florida, come visit. Everybody gets down to Florida once a year at least to do something. There's got to be an AI conference coming in Miami. There's got
to
be.
Oh, man. I've been down to Aruba, but not Florida. Maybe I got to do Florida next time.
You'll get down to Florida. Look, you can get Dan's AI in Business podcast over on Apple Podcasts. Everywhere else that good podcasts are found. Also, tell them your website where they can find more information, please.
Totally. It's emerj.com. So emerge, but with a J, emerj.com. So if people are into the business impact of AI, we've got a great newsletter, some good podcasts they might like.
Good stuff. Thank you so much. Appreciate it, buddy.
Excellent. Thank you, Andrew.
All right. Now, wasn't that great? That was a great interview with Dan Figella. I always enjoy spending time with him. He is just a bundle of really good information, a really smart guy too. So I learned a lot there. Some things that actually I think that are somewhat actionable, or at least that I can incorporate into some of the work that I'm doing with regard to understanding more about how companies are going to effectively leverage AI. So something that I'll think about, I'll probably listen to that a couple times more, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. Thanks for joining me this week and every week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Don't forget to tell your friends, your family, everybody, shout out from the corners that this is a podcast that you listen to. This and, of course, DH Unplugged every week. But thank you so much for being here. Go over to disciplinedinvestor.com. You'll find the show notes. We have some new show notes that are actually AI generated on every single episode over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The guest segment, we take that and we just post the notes that is done so well by AI. And you'll see it. You got to check it out. It's pretty cool. Thanks again for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.